Call the next case, number 24-1719, United States against James Bost. Mr. Nightingale?
Morning.
Morning.
My name is Attorney Patrick Nightingale. I represent the appellant, James Bost, and I would like to request 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
And as a threshold matter, I'm compelled to advise the court that in my zeal and enthusiasm for preparing for my first ever argument before a panel of the Third Circuit, I forgot my hearing aids. So if at any point in time I ask for one of your honors to repeat the question, that's why, and I apologize in advance.
No problem. We will try to lean into the microphone.
I appreciate that. James Bost is one of the people protected by the plain text of the Second Amendment. He is entitled to possess a firearm for self-defense. Because the plain text of the Second Amendment covers Mr. Bost, we then move to the second step of the Bruin analysis and ask the question,
entitled to possess any weapon he can get his hands on for self-defense.
Essentially, that's our argument, Your Honor, because what Heller tells us is that the right...
A bazooka?
That the Second Amendment...
How about a bazooka?
I'm sorry?
Is he allowed to have a bazooka?
No, that's one of the limits that Heller does place on the possession of, you know, common firearms or common weapons that would be associated with self-defense. It is not an unlimited or...
To have a weapon that he knows was stolen?
Well, you know, that's a good question in this case. Obviously, he pled guilty to being in possession of a stolen weapon. And the factual record that was developed merely set forth that Mr. Bost said the gun is probably stolen.
Probably stolen.
Meaning that he didn't buy it. But that was not an affirmation that I knew for a fact beyond a reasonable doubt that the gun was stolen. But that's not a defense to possession of a stolen weapon in federal court or in state court. So, of course, you know, it is being in mere possession of that stolen weapon was sufficient to establish the crime.
Do we consider whether the weapon was stolen at Bruin step one or step two?
Now, I would say it's only to be considered at step two. And here's why I do not believe it should be considered at step one, because this right to self-defense is a natural individualized right. And armed self-defense is at the heart of the Second Amendment. What Heller tells us is that the Second Amendment does not create this right. It merely, you know, puts this right on paper. It codifies this right, which is a natural right that exists for Mr. Bost. And the corollary that I would ask the panel to consider is that does Mr. Bost lose his right, his fundamental right for armed self-defense, merely because the instrument in question happens to be stolen? And I would submit the answer is no. And here's
but you need historical analogs, right? I understand your argument to be that there are no historical analogs here because there aren't laws from the time of the founding that speak about stolen firearms. Is that your argument?
That is my argument.
Okay, but perhaps a problem with that is that there are plenty of laws from the relevant time period that prohibit thievery and possessing stolen property writ large. You would concede that?
Absolutely.
Okay. So the question becomes whether that's a sufficient analog. And I guess my question to you is there any evidence that there is a carve out from the general prohibition on possessing stolen property that favors firearms?
That carve out is the Second Amendment. That carve out is my client's natural and individual right to possess a firearm for self-defense.
All right, but does that mean that there are no carve outs? When I was asking about carve outs, I was asking about statutory carve outs.
I am not.
You don't have any.
No, I do not have any.
All right, so your argument is that you don't have any, but you don't need any because of the pre-existing natural right to protect oneself, which was codified by the Second Amendment.
That is my argument, Your Honor, and that's what I would submit distinguishes a firearm from other chattels, as the government sets forth in its brief. What makes a firearm unique to a cart, a horse, a piece of paper?
All right, but how do you get around our recent decisions that, for example, you don't have a right to have a firearm in prison? Well, prisoners would like to defend themselves from violence, correct?
Absolutely.
So how do you, why do you win under that theory of overarching Second Amendment right to self-defense when we've already held that in certain contexts that doesn't obtain?
Well, there's a difference, I would submit, between whether you are detained in a custodial setting pretrial or whether you were released on bond or on bail pretrial. In the custodial setting, I would agree with Your Honor, absolutely. You're not entitled to bring a firearm inside the jail cell to protect yourself from fellow inmates, however, you know, however much an inmate may desire to do so. But where we don't have the historical record, and where the government, I submit, fails on its burden, is the government cannot show that those who are released on bail in colonial America were disarmed as a matter of course, or disarmed at all. The historical record is completely absent in this case to address that specific question about whether or not someone who was granted bond, and in this case, Mr. Bost absolutely was granted bond for simple assault and terroristic threats, posted about 2 weeks after his arrest, but we have no historical analog, and I know we don't need a twin. I know that what we need is something that is consistent with the nation's tradition and history of disarming individuals, but what we don't have is any record of those who are granted bail in colonial America of having been disarmed, like I said, either as a matter of course or at all. We just don't know.
In colonial America, did anybody have the right to possess someone else's firearm?
Well, I think that's a very interesting question. And
It's an important question, isn't it?
I mean, I'm sorry?
It's an important question.
It's a very important question.
The Bill of Rights was adopted on top of other rights that people had at that time. And the right to possess their own property, wasn't that one of their rights?
Yes, certainly that is a right to possess one's own property.
Mr. Bost were back in those days. Does he have the right to possess somebody else's firearm?
A question I would ask the panel to consider is in the context of a militia man, hey, I'm being called up for militia duty. I don't have my firearm, but my neighbor's firearm is available to me. He's out on a 8-month hunting trip or whatever, so I'm taking his firearm to do my duty. Or similarly, if someone—
Well, but this isn't a case involving a bailment or permitted use. This is illegal possession by definition, possession of stolen property.
Yeah, that is correct, but it butts up against my client's again fundamental individual natural right to use that firearm for self-defense. And I readily concede that when the defense comes and makes an argument like this, the facts aren't always as good as I would hope them to be. The facts are what they are, and it's what myself and Mr. Bost are stuck with.
So if you can get this to step two, how can you win? How can you convince us?
Well, pursuant to range, we look at the individual assessment of Mr. Bost and whether or not he's dangerous. I would note that the Department of Justice answered this question of dangerousness on behalf of a defendant recently seeking to have his firearms rights reinstated, who beat his wife and had a very public alcohol addiction. The actor Mel Gibson got his Second Amendment rights reinstated last week by the Department of Justice for a 2011 assault, whereas I'm seeking to have my client's Second Amendment rights vindicated relative to a 2002 simple
assault.
Is that
through a declaratory judgment action?
It was a declaratory judgment action.
In California? Or
I'm sorry?
Was that a court rule? That was a court decision in California that you're referring to in the Gibson case?
Yes. The Department of Justice just approved Mr. Gibson's reinstatement of his Second Amendment rights.
Well, that's not a court. The DOJ is not the court.
No, but the DOJ.
So was it a discretionary decision by DOJ or was it a court ruling?
Not a court ruling yet. It was the Department of Justice essentially agreeing that Mr. Gibson has met his burden of showing that he is no longer dangerous.
All right, but that doesn't help you because what DOJ or ATF does with respect to a citizen's Second Amendment rights is a matter of grace, not a matter of constitutional right.
I understand. I'm merely pointing it out that as we look to that second step, as applied, looking at the individual assessment of dangerousness, I find it at least noteworthy for the panel to consider that the Department of Justice, in a situation where someone has a very similar crime with a similar punishment, that individual assessment fell on that person's
behalf. What about someone who's a bail jumper and someone who's been a cocaine addict, uses cocaine every day for a period of about 20 years?
Well, I would point
to
the-
over that?
I would point to United States versus Connolly that there was no evidence that my client was under the influence of cocaine at the time of his arrest. And had he been, he could very easily have been charged with 18 United States Code 922 G3 as an unlawful user.
Possession of marijuana, with sales of marijuana. Didn't he have a drunken driving back in there?
Yes, that was a cannabis case, and I would submit that it would be reasonable to infer that Mr. Connolly was a regular user of cannabis, but what that case hinged on...
He said he was a regular user of cocaine.
Yes, my client did admit that he was a regular user of cocaine, but again, relative to the as-applied analysis, there was no evidence of him being under the influence of cocaine at the time that he was arrested and found in possession of the stolen firearm.
And the bail jumping, that's not evidence of dangerousness?
Bail jumping, the distinction that I would make is when we hear the term fugitive from justice, it seems to confer this notion that someone is actively running from the law, they're being pursued. You know, Tommy Lee Jones is, you know, hot on Harrison Ford's heels, but not merely missing a hearing.
There are different ways to jump bail. Yes. I concede that. But and here you're saying in the pantheon of bail jumpers, your guy's not so bad. Is that
not so bad for simply failing to show up for a court date?
Okay.
I wanted to go back to the step one, step two question, because when I asked it the first time, you said we answer that at step two. But your argument sounded like a step one argument because it's natural rights and it's sort of, he's a member of the people, he wants to defend himself and use a gun. He gets to do that sort of full stop. So where do you see that argument taking place? Is it a step one or step two?
I think it has to take place at both, because the district court in this matter said that Mr. Boss doesn't get past step one because of the 922J charge. So I think in addressing it before this panel, I have to confront that at step one, but then also preserve that and make that argument at step two. So yes, you're exactly right. It seems I'm making it at both steps, but I feel I'm compelled to do so, especially since the district court said, yeah, he's a member of the people relative to 922G1, but not 922J.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Nightingale. Let's hear from Mr. Kokas.
I did not realize I was going to be up against Mel Gibson and Tommy Lee Jones. Yeah. May it please the court, Donovan Kokas on behalf of the United States. I know we're limited on time, so if I could, I'd like to just spend 1 minute clearing the deck to get to the 922G step one issue, because I think that's where this thing goes. I don't have anything to add in my brief on the Commerce Clause issue. On the constitutional vagueness issue, I've just sharpened one point I made, which is that this is a statute that's clear on its face as drafted by Article One and as enacted by Article Two. To the extent there's some vagary now about the extent of its application, that's solely because of Article Three interpretations of it, Bruin and Post. I couldn't find any case that finds a statute unconstitutionally vague on that basis. If anything, what I found is the opposite, was that a statute which is arguably vague as written and as enacted can sometimes be saved by limiting interpretations of the courts. But I can't find one where the courts have made a clear statute vague. The 922J, everything I'm going to say about 922G1, and in particular, the as-applied challenge is going to apply here equally. And then as to the 922G1 issue, the facial challenge, I would just point out now that this court has decided Moore and Quayles, we know of at least two broad classes of people to whom the statute can be applied constitutionally. I submit, therefore, that means it's now sort of a settled issue that it is constitutional on its face, at least, that really all that's left is as applied challenges. So now that just brings me to the 922G1 as applied challenge. I followed the two-step Bruin process on this, and I can make a couple concessions now in light of range two. I couldn't concede at the time that he was a person for Second Amendment purposes. I do now after range two. So that settles the first half of the first step. The second half of this first step, which is where I think the rubber meets the road, I can concede that the purpose for which he claimed this, self-defense, on its face, if you don't look at any of the other facts, would be a valid constitutional purpose. Where I think his problem is, though, is that under Heller and not overruled by Bruin or by Rahimi, he also has to show that the particular weapon he possessed falls within the ambit of the Second Amendment. And that's where I think that his argument falls apart.
All right, it's not a bazooka. It's the typical weapon, right? It's a handgun, and that's fine. But for the fact that no right to possess it.
Right.
He has no possessory interest in it because it was stolen.
That's correct. Yeah. So it's not. We don't just stop at handgun, because if we did, like, for example, I mean, in range two, that if the person seeking the declaratory judgment said, I want to possess a rifle for hunting, a shotgun for self-defense, this court said he could. I think your honors would be very surprised if he construed that as permission to go out and get a sawed-off shotgun or a fully automatic rifle or one or both.
Those are illegal weapons under current law, and the handgun is not an illegal weapon under current law.
But a stolen handgun is per se. That's the problem. It's the stolen status of it.
All right. Is it the stolen status or his knowledge of the fact that it's probably stolen?
Well,
what's the difference?
In pleading guilt, I mean, at the time of his arrest, he said it's probably stolen.
Probably stolen.
In pleading guilty, he said, I knew it was stolen, because that's an element of the offense.
He deserved the right to challenge, make the Second Amendment challenge.
The Second Amendment challenge, but not to challenge his knowledge of this. I mean, that issue settled by his plea. So whatever this court decides, it's going to be based on the premise that if someone possesses a stolen firearm knowing it's stolen.
Yeah, but I mean, my point is, does your argument apply to the possession of any stolen firearm or only to a firearm that the person knew was probably stolen?
I would say at least it applies to one they knew were probably sold. So there could be a good faith
case.
The facts of this case. I wouldn't go broader because I can't anticipate. Maybe someone might have a good faith defense somewhere along the line. I don't know. That just isn't this case, though. Okay. I'd propose a helpful way to think about this first step under Bruin. Bruin said the second step, where the burden is ours, is a how and a why question. The first step I submit is a who and a what question. Who is the person a member of the people? And then what is it they're claiming the right to do? That's both what is the weapon and what is the purpose for which they want to keep it. I think if the court analyzes it that way, now you actually have a structure. It's not one from Rahimi or Bruin, but you have a structure that you can reconcile with both of those decisions. And I submit that the burden has to be the plaintiff, well, Mr. Bost's, at this stage of the thing. I think the court might have assumed.
So we agree that he's a who.
He's
among
who,
the people.
But I think
you're saying he loses at step one because of the what?
Because
he
can't show the what. So this is why I need to.
Why isn't it enough to show the what by saying a handgun is in common use? That's enough.
Absolutely, Your Honor. So here's the structure I'd propose for answering that question. It comes right out of the Moore and Bank decision. It says you answer the what question by asking two questions, really. One, can you think of any common sense reason why a law-abiding citizen would keep this weapon for some law-abiding purpose, self-defense, say? If you can't, you then ask, is there any evidence in the record to show that law-abiding citizens nevertheless keep that kind of weapon for self-defense? That puts the burden squarely on the shoulders of the proponent to make that, to either argue common sense allows him to possess a stolen firearm or to show that law-abiding citizens nevertheless do.
All right, so let me give you a counterfactual. Does that mean then that in a case where someone like Mr. Bost has a stolen gun, but has a really good argument to explain why he didn't know it was stolen and shouldn't have known it was stolen.
Mm-hmm.
Do you concede then that that person gets past step one?
I would concede he doesn't get convicted in the first place. See, that's the statute is what has him here. The fact that he's here under 922J for admitting that he knowingly possessed a stolen gun, that's what opens the door to this. Now, if you're talking 922G1, right? Let's just assume he's a felon, but he had a stolen gun. Then it may be that you proceed to the second step. I don't know the answer to that.
Let me suggest a reason from the cases why it might be a step two question, and then you can respond. So the common use language from Bruin, it says it's undisputed the petitioners are part of the people whom the Second Amendment protects, nor does any party dispute the handguns are weapons in common use today for self-defense. And then it cites Heller. Mm-hmm. So you go back to Heller and look for the common use language. This is where it first appears. And the court said, we recognize an important limitation on the right to keep and carry arms. Miller, you know, said that these sorts of weapons, that the sorts of weapons protected were those in common use at the time. So that's from Miller. And then the next sentence is, we think that limitation is fairly supported by the historical tradition of prohibiting the carrying of dangerous and unusual weapons. Mm-hmm. So it seems like the Heller court was saying, in Bruin's language, that's a step two question. We look at the historical tradition. It's not a language issue like you would find at step one. It's a historical tradition question.
Well, so I'd answer that the following way. All the cases I've been able to find that have reached this step one issue post Bruin and even post Rahimi have regarded this as a step one question. There was some debate in the Fourth Circuit about this. The reason why I think it belongs there is Bruin itself compared the Second Amendment right to a First Amendment right. Under the First Amendment, someone has to show that his conduct is even covered by the First Amendment before we reach the next question, which is, can the government justify its regulation? That's out of a case called Clark versus Community for Creative Nonviolence in 1984, okay? So that's why I think he has to be able to show that the particular weapon he possessed or wants to possess is in common use by law-abiding citizens. I mean, and I have no problem with what the court, you know, assumed in range two, that that's true of rifles, shotguns. There's no data supporting that, make no mistake about it, but common sense tells you that's right, that's enough. Heller itself assumed handguns were in common use.
Well, the DOJ data supports it because when you look at DOJ homicide statistics, right, it's overwhelmingly handguns.
Right, but my point is at that first step, he should be the one introducing the data. I shouldn't be the one having to mine the data and prove the negative. I think I did that in this case only because Gore seemed unwilling to accept the common sense proposition that law-abiding citizens don't possess stolen firearms for a legitimate reason. So I thought, well, the data exists. I might as well look at it. I can honestly, it's not perfect. It can't be because we don't know how many firearms are out there in civilian use out there right now. But I think I have a pretty good idea, and my visceral sense from the numbers I ran suggests that stolen guns aren't common, period, but they're something like 20 times more likely to find their way into crime scenes. So that suggests to me that it's not something that lawful, law-abiding citizens are going to use for something like self-defense, and that makes common sense. If you had a stolen gun and you shoot someone in self-defense, the police come, they get all interested in the gun you used, they're going to find out that you had a stolen firearm. Yes, Mr. Nightingale's point, it doesn't make it a homicide, but you're going to face charges for having a stolen firearm. So, and then I know the court said in range two, it rejected the idea that law abiding could define the people. And I need to address that because that makes sense because if someone has a traffic ticket, they might never, you know, now that's even broader than felon, right? They're never going to be law abiding ever, ever again. So that would be a way of dispossessing people of their Second Amendment rights forever. But I submit to you that law abiding is the only way to look at what's in common use because, first of all, it just would eliminate a certain kind of weapon and not even forever. I mean, at the founding, handguns were not at all very common because they were rare and unreliable. Now they are common. Conversely, at the founding, handguns or any kind of guns with serial numbers were not only uncommon, they were non-existent because they didn't start being serialized until like Smith & Wesson and Colt did in the mid-1800s. Yet, nevertheless, if you agree with Price, law-abiding citizens don't possess them for legitimate reasons. If you were to read law-abiding out of that inquiry, the problem I have with it is you are essentially saying, forget legal or illegal, what weapons are commonly used out there? You'd then be allowing criminals to essentially define the scope of the Second Amendment right for not only themselves, but for everybody else. That's one problem. The other problem, it's to me that, and I know it's dictum from Heller, but it's Supreme Court dictum, and it appears in cases thereafter. The court said this is not meant to upset longstanding regulations.
Right.
And
there was no citation after that statement.
No citation after the statement. But here's where I think it goes, Your Honor. I think it belongs there in that first step as to the what. Because if you were to assume away all the regulations, you'd be essentially going, okay, we have a default of zero regulations. That's just like 1791. We are told to analogize to what the founders did and how broadly they intended to define the interest in 1791, we weren't told to pretend we are in 1791. This whole suite of regulations has to have some, I can't call it a presumption, but some kind of assumption until proven otherwise that those are lawful. So to sum up on that, I think to construe the phrase law-abiding, commonly used by law-abiding citizen, I think that just means citizens who are abiding the whatever the relevant current sphere of firearms laws is. If you read it that way, because I have to assume it means something, right? And it can't, that longstanding presumption or whatever it is, can't be applied at step two because we have the burden at step two. So what would that mean? If you applied it at step two, would that eliminate the burden? Would it lighten the burden? I would have expected the Supreme Court to say something like that, and it just doesn't. So I think that's how Your Honors can reach that.
Well, I don't know. It seems like Bruin altered that unsighted dictum about longstanding prohibitions, because when Bruin set up the requirement of showing historical analogs, that requires the government to come forward with something to show that the current prohibition on firearms had some historical pedigree, right? And here the pedigree is laws saying you can't possess stolen property. And I assume, you know, your argument is you don't have any evidence that even says one way or another that guns were treated specifically in regard to stolen property law. There's at least we couldn't find anything on that. Is there anything out there on that?
Well, I found that all of the 13 colonies had laws against stolen property, beginning with Virginia in 1619, right, all the way up through Georgia in the 1750s. Three of those jurisdictions had laws specifically prohibiting transfers of firearms to groups they considered were dangerous. Massachusetts said you can't transfer them to Native Americans. Virginia said both Native Americans and enslaved populations. South Carolina said the latter. So
the closest you have is a regulatory effort in that era to prevent guns from falling into, quote, the wrong hands.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the closest. If we get to step two.
But that's not really. If you're to prevail here, that wouldn't seem to be the proper route. The proper route is to say that you can't have stolen property and, right, and there's not a gun exemption to that general rule.
That's right, I think. And you know, the defendant or Mr. Bost hasn't proven that there was, I think the burden's on him at that first step to prove there was some sort of carve out for firearms, and he just hasn't done anything like that. That said, if you get to step two, you see all the reasons why Mr. Bost could have been disarmed consistent with the Second Amendment. This is kind of a target-rich environment because of how dangerous his criminal record is, and he wasn't just out on bond, he actually became a fugitive. And yeah, I get there are fugitives and there are fugitives, but the fact of the matter is, when you're a fugitive from your bond, you know, the court's going to issue.
It seemed like he was much of a fugitive. He didn't go far.
He's a no-show. Yeah.
He's not a no-show. Runner. But the point is, the court then issues a body attachment, which means that people with guns are going to come try to arrest you when they can. So if you then possess yourself.
So you argue then it's inherent, a bail jumper is inherently dangerous by virtue of the chain of events that ensues naturally from trying to apprehend a bail jumper.
A bail jumper who then acquires a gun.
While cocaine usage.
Yeah, every single day, 1 to 3 grams a day. If you assume 2 grams a day, that's the better part of a kilo a year for 27 years. That covers his entire criminal history, everything he did. So I don't know how.
Did you know what time of day he was apprehended?
I don't believe it does. I'm sure there is a record. I just don't think there is one in our record.
When we're looking at evidence of dangerousness, should we consider convicted conduct, post-conviction conduct? Can we ask his neighbors, is he a good guy? Does he drink too much? Does he yell at his kids? Like, how far do we go?
I don't know if you could do that last. I don't know if that last thing would be enough, but like Pizzolatti's seemed to say, even if you've committed a crime that's not inherently dangerous, maybe we can look to the underlying facts of that crime to determine.
Of that crime.
Yeah, right. If you did it in a dangerous way,
yeah.
I think that might be the right balance.
This area might be immune from the categorical approach. Is that what you're saying?
Well, that's what Your Honor said and more, right? So I hope you meant it.
We try to mean what we say.
Yes. Unless the court has any other questions, we'd ask Your Honors to affirm.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Kokas. Let's hear a rebuttal.
Thank you. I wanted to make comment on a couple of things that the government argued. One, that handguns were rare at the founding. I don't think that we necessarily have any evidence in record to suggest that handguns were rare at the founding, and that has any relevance on whether or not.
Well, that doesn't. He wasn't arguing that means that your client shouldn't have had a handgun because it was an exotic weapon or not. It's clearly included in the what the Supreme Court made clear. So you're fine on that.
And when it comes to the Heller analysis of a firearm that's dangerous or unusual, I would submit that the legal status of that firearm does not commit or transmit a firearm from being normal, something that is an everyday use, something that the courts have recognized as a handgun as a preferred firearm for self-defense, that changes that handgun into a dangerous or unusual instrument because that handgun happened to be stolen.
Isn't there a lot of statistical evidence to show that stolen firearms with erased or obliterated serial numbers are sort of the criminal's weapon of choice?
I will certainly concede to the government's mathematical and statistical analysis of how stolen firearms are used in crimes. But what is absent from that, and what I think is a central part of the argument that Mr. Bost has an individual and natural right to armed self-defense, regardless of whether or not that firearm is stolen, is we have no analysis of how often a stolen firearm is used in a legitimate act of self-defense. And I would submit that type of analysis would be informative to the court, and it does actually happen on an everyday basis.
Isn't that Mr. Boss' burden to show that?
No, I believe it's the government's burden to show that stolen firearms are not.
What about at step one?
Well, I disagree with the government that at step one that I have to show that Mr. Boss' possession of the.
Step one, have you shown that stolen firearms are not more dangerous than firearms acquired through lawful means?
I would submit that the legal status of the firearm itself, in and of itself, we're just talking about this inanimate piece of metal with bullets in it, that being stolen or not stolen does not affect its dangerousness. What the person employing that firearm does with that stolen firearm affects whether or not that stolen firearm is more likely than not to be used in a crime.
So people who have and use firearms with serial numbers that have been scratched off tend to do more dangerous things than people who have the exact same gun with the serial number intact.
But let's look at that in the context.
Is that kind of the point of your argument?
I'll concede what the government put in its brief that yes, stolen firearms are used often or an obliterated serial number. I'll throw that into the mix. I've got no problem with that.
But the focus is on the user, not the gun.
Yeah, the focus is on the user's right, the user's fundamental natural right to use a firearm for self-defense, which is at the heart of the Second Amendment, as Heller instructs us. And that merely being a dangerous firearm, or strike that, merely being a stolen firearm does not convert that instrument, that handgun, into a dangerous or unusual firearm that should be separately regulated. But trust me, I understand the difficulty of arguing that I have a fundamental Second Amendment right to possess a stolen firearm for self-defense. Not the greatest facts for Mr. Bost. However, he still retains that fundamental natural right to use a firearm for self-defense. And I would ask this court, this panel, to reject the notion that under no circumstances whatsoever could a stolen firearm be employed for lawful purposes. I would submit that we just can't go that far, especially in the context.
Couldn't we agree with what you just said and still rule against Mr. Bost in this case? For example, let's assume that prior to his arrest that brought him into federal court here, a rival attacked him and shot at him, and he returned fire and killed the rival. Isn't it possible that that would have been a no prosecution, because if the investigation showed that it was perfectly appropriate and necessary self-defense, he might have been given a pass for a legitimate homicide, and then quickly thereafter prosecuted for the very same crime that he was prosecuted here? Can't both of those things happen?
Both of those things could happen, Your Honor. That's a challenge for Mr. Bost.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Nightingale. We appreciate it. Mr. Kokas, we'll take the matter under advisement.